This is from Running the Books, The Adventures of an Accidental Prison Librarian by Avi Steinberg.
This seemed to do the trick. I was told the position, which included working as a librarian and a creative writing teacher, was mine. That is, on condition my background check was clean and that I passed a drug test. "No problem," I said. And I had thought that it wasn't. But as it turned out, I was wrong. I realized after the interview that my pre-wedding smoke with Yoni, roughly 2 months earlier, would most certainly pose a problem. What would happen if I failed the drug test? This wasn't a typical employer. It was, after all, the sheriff's department. The guy who'd sold Yoni the marijuana might be sitting in a cell in this very prison. I had a bad feeling about this. When the head of personnel called to discuss benefits and payment plans, she asked me point blank, "Are you going to pass this test?" "Yes," I replied reflexively, "of course." How did she know to ask? I wondered. Was there something about me? The nefarious mop top? Did she really want to discuss this issue openly? Blissfully ignorant of the prison's internal investigative division and their habit of tapping phone conversations, I decided to level with her, thinking perhaps she'd give me a break. "Well," I said, "I did smoke once. I mean, most recently a while ago, though, at a party. I mean, it was a wedding, actually, and it was obviously before the wedding, the party at the wedding, I mean." I winced. "But that shouldn't be a problem, right?" Dead silence. "Hello?" I said. "It's a hiatus," she said finally. On the phone and thrown off balance, I was having trouble with the Boston brogue. "A what?" I asked her. "Hiatus," she said, and quickly changed the subject to dental plan options. That night, I searched online for information on drug screening. Within two clicks, I understood that the woman from personnel had been trying to tip me off. I was facing a hair test. I delved into the minutiae of this screening method. In addition to being alarmingly accurate, it also covered a longer period of time than the imprecise, tamper-prone urinalysis. Apparently hair, even more than urine, is articulate of its master's misdeeds. This didn't surprise me. I'd always held quiet beliefs about hair, vague but persistent suspicions of a treacherous, even demonic aspect, the more sinister for its allure. It grows beautifully even though it's dead. That's creepy. I'd always sensed it wasn't to be trusted. Now was the time to act. The incriminating data was hidden at a certain point in every strand of hair on my head. I had to locate, then remove, evidence. A wonderful start to a job at the sheriff's department. There was only one surefire way to accomplish this: to shave my head completely. But I'd been taught etiquette, and it was bad manners to arrive at a hair test with no hair. I'd have to take a risk. Tell Manny the barber to go as short as possible and hope the evidence ended up on the floor of his shop.
This is from It's Not Just Who You Know. Transform your life and your organization by turning colleagues and contacts into lasting, genuine relationships by Tommy Spaulding.
The village of Suffern, New York, sits peacefully near the base of the Ramapo Mountains, just 26 miles northwest of New York City. The 11,000 or so residents form a community within a patchwork of other tight-knit towns and villages, where a mix of blue-collar workers and big-city commuters represent the best of colonial heritage and urban grit. My parents raised me there on a steady diet of traditional family values that placed high importance on serving others and a great emphasis on hard work and education. The serving and hard work came easily. The education, however, was another matter. Nothing melted my spirits faster like hot asphalt on an August day. I feared being called stupid by my teachers and classmates because I believed that was what my grades indicated. I failed classes outright or passed by the skin of my teeth, only to fail the end-of-year standardized tests and have to attend summer school to make up the credit, all while working on my homework and studies as hard as, and usually harder than, the other kids I knew. My self-confidence took a beating. The more embarrassed I became by my grades, the more I tried to compensate by achieving things in non-academic areas, participating in athletics, running for student government, earning Eagle Scout honors. In much the same way as a blind person experiences sensory compensation, I seem to make up for my academic limitations with a heightened ability to communicate with and connect to other people.
This is From the Watch by Joydeep Roy Bhattacharya.
The men begin to gather round, looking warily first at the dead man and then at Elizadeh. I say, "I think the assumption we're making is that you're Muslim." He laughs awkwardly. "I'm Methodist, Doc. My mom's Pennsylvania Dutch. She wouldn't have it any other way. I go to church like everyone else." I curse inwardly at the connection I've inadvertently made between Elizadeh and the dead Talib, but before I can speak, he continues. "I mean, my grandpa arrived from Iran and all, but that was way back in the 40s. Both grandpa and pa worked for Ford. Why, grandpa was in the design team that built the 57 Ford Fairlane, the sweetest car that came out of the line that year." Jackson, a known aficionado of the classic Detroit years, whistles softly. "No kidding. 57 Fairlane, huh?" He crouches next to the dead man and studies his black turban with as much avid attention as if it were the front grill of the Fairlane. Then, "I don't know, Nate. I mean, the Fairlane was sweet and all, but in terms of that particular year, I'd go for the Bel Air myself." It's Elizadeh's turn to crouch on the other side of the dead man. "You gotta be kidding, right? The Chevy Bel Air was nothing. The next time you're in Detroit, I'll take you on a test drive in the Fairlane. You'll see." "You got one?" "Damn right we got one. It fucking lights up the highway." They go at it back and forth as the tension in the air palpably dissipates. Then Shot collects himself and says, All right, cut it out." He turns to me. "So what does the damn turban mean?" The men wait for me to answer, but in a half-hearted manner, their attention clearly still on the car conversation. I clear my throat, already feeling didactic even before I've spoken. "Well," I remark, "the black turban means the man is a Sa'id, a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad." Shot seems unimpressed. "I thought the black turban meant he was Taliban." "Not all black turbans are the same. The Taliban loop theirs differently." "So?" Grohl says. "So is he a mullah or what?" Elizadeh interjects with a crooked grin. "My grandpa used to say, the only good mullah is a dead one. He fucking hated them." He looks at me sideways. "You've been taking Taliban Turban 101, Doc?" He laughs, delighted with himself, and Jackson laughs with him. Soon they're all roaring with laughter, and Elizadeh laughs the loudest, his nativist credentials safely reestablished.